You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Break a Bat podcast, where baseball meets Broadway. An attempt to show that my two favorite mediums don't have to live in such separate worlds and maybe even break some stigmas. We're happy to have you with us. Now let's play ball. Hello and welcome to Break a Bat. I'm your host, Al Malafronte, coming at you for the Broadway Podcast Network. This is a special show for me. Obviously, I'd like to think my passion for what I get to do on this podcast shines through in every chat that I have. But every once in a while, we're joined by someone whose art and work has played a huge role in your life. And sometimes that goes all the way back to childhood. For me personally, and I'm sure for many in our audience, my first introduction to both comedy and entertainment and even musical theater comes from the world of the Muppets. Now, since this is a show where sports and entertainment kind of collide, I think it's important for everyone to know. I've talked in the past about how I'm the commissioner of my fantasy baseball league. Over the years, there's been a number of nicknames that I've tacked on to some friends who play in the league based on their personalities that kind of mirror various Muppets. I mean, the great Nico was inspired by the great Gonzo. Rizzo the Rat is a name that CJ Oliveri has taken on. And even going back to my childhood, my Italian cousins, Dino and Danny, a classic comedy team, they were always Bert and Ernie. And believe it or not, I still call them that all these years later, whether they like it or not. And, you know, the Muppets really inspired me to want to work in entertainment. When I was a junior in college, my first internship was at Kaufman Astoria Studios, where Sesame Street was taped, and nothing short of a dream come true to be around some of the creatives. However, there were a few days that year, more so than others, that I really felt like I belonged. And that's very much thanks to our special guest tonight. Cold March day, Sesame was about to tape an episode called The Flood, and a legendary puppeteer was going to be on set to perform Ernie, my favorite character. And while I know all you Muppet fans know him, that puppeteer just happens to be the great Steve Whitmire, and he treated me like gold. We talked shop, and you never know that my most important job that day was probably to grab someone's coffee. Tonight, we're lucky enough to be joined by Steve. Just to give you some background on him, he got his start as one of the lead puppeteers with Jim Henson on The Muppet Show in 1978, where he created another favorite of mine in Rizzo the Rat. He also worked on Fraggle Rock, The Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, all the major Muppet films. And after Jim Henson's passing in 1990, he was tapped as the man to succeed him as the performer of Kermit the Frog, as well as Ernie, roles that he performed incredibly up until the mid-2010s. And in doing so, I think he was one of the main guys, if not the main guy, to keep Jim's legacy and lineage tradition alive with both the Muppets and on Sesame Street. And if you love Broadway like I do, you always admire someone who's a master at creating and developing characters. And when you look at my guest's incredible body of work shooting with the Muppets and Sesame here in New York City, I thought of no one more appropriate to bring on Break a Bat tonight. And he's still doing phenomenal work with his own character, Weldon the IT Guy on the Cave-In series, in which he created and also stars in. And we're so grateful he could join us tonight. So with that being said, if you'll please turn your attention to home plate, just beyond the marquee, now batting, Steve Whitmire. Steve, welcome.
Thank you. My goodness, that was a great introduction. I just have to send you a check or something.
I tried to cover all bases. And back home, I do still keep a little memento from our day together over at Kaufman. I think you might have told me that was the first day that Kermit the Frog ever signed a baseball.
it would have been. Yeah, it would have been. I don't think we signed very many baseballs. I did remember that day because it was a rare thing to sign a baseball. Very nice. Very nice. I'm glad you have that.
Oh, it's one of my favorite pieces of memorabilia for sure. You know, did you yourself keep much memorabilia from your Muppet days? You know,
I had a small room in one of our houses. We moved to a different house now, but this house had about like a 10 by 12 spare bedroom. And it started out as a great little place with little shelves on the wall, nice little museum-y kind of thing. So for almost 40 years, I collected, you know, they would send me toys and items and, I mean, everything. I had all this stuff, all displayed nicely. And over the course of the years, it came down to this point where I was just sort of opening the door and throwing the next thing in there and shutting the door really quickly. So it was a mess. I mean, I don't know whether anybody knows the reference of Fibber McGee's Closet, but there was you open the door and everything started falling out. So about, I guess it's probably 10 years ago now, I decided to donate all of that stuff, except for just a few key pieces, because I thought, I don't have kids. I thought, what am I going to do with all this stuff? So I donated it to the Center for Puppetry Arts in Atlanta. And they're big supporters of Henson and of Jim's work. And Jim was a great supporter of theirs. And they auctioned off this stuff, and I autographed a bunch of it. And, you know, they didn't make a fortune, but they made a little money off of it. And people, you know, the items went to people who are really going to appreciate having them, I think.
Yeah, that's amazing. I remember when you were doing that. And I saw, I haven't been to the exhibit, but I saw that, you know, what they've done is really great. And, you know, yeah. Speaking of your hometown, Atlanta, Steve, are you on the set of Cave-In as we speak right now?
I am actually. Yeah. I don't know. I guess people can't see this, but I'm very near the set. We found this little studio. I'm working with a young man named Liam Nelson, who has his own small production company called New Heaven Productions, and growing actually quite a bit. And we had access to this very small, this is actually just a little photo studio, but to do something like Cave-In, which is, you know, a small thing. And we shoot these production numbers, which look big, but they're actually shot quite small, mostly against green screen. And so it's a great little spot, you know, and he's using the facility for other things as well. So it's worked out quite well. We've actually kind of built it and turned it into a studio. I mean, the building was here, but we made it into a functioning space.
I think it's so awesome what you've been able to accomplish with Cave-In and really just a short time. I think you started it last fall. And can you tell the folks at home a little about what you're doing with Weldon, the IT guy?
Sure. Well, Weldon came about because I went to a local group called, well, you know, Adult Swim probably. Sure. They have a, I didn't go to their television people. I went to their internet people. And they have this, you know, if you haven't ever gone to their website, it is bizarre. It's just like hour long stuff. They will put it, pretty much anybody on, I think. I mean, I don't know. It's like cable access used to be back in the 70s or 80s. And I just thought, what a great place to have a character who would critique all the stuff that's on there, because you could tear it apart and but do it nicely, you know. So I thought, well, an internet troll, it's an internet thing, it's their website. And I don't think they ever quite understood exactly what I was hoping to try to do. I tried to explain it, but it didn't quite make sense. So I had this idea for this character. And once I had the idea, I had to build the puppet. I had to, you know, come up with the character. So we started doing our own monthly live stream. A month is about all I could pull together on my own. And I'm really doing the whole thing myself. I mean, every part of it. You know, I conceive the numbers. I write everything. I work with a guy named Jim Lewis, who's worked with us on the Muppets for many years. Jim helps me with some of the writing, thank goodness. And then I've got Liam to help me, and my wife actually helps me puppeteer. But it's very small, very kind of in-house thing. And Weldon just basically is this miserable little troll. He's an internet troll who hacks people, but he's literally a troll, lives in a cave, and wants to hear about your misery so people can call in and talk to Weldon. So we've got this little cult following thing going on now, which is quite fun.
It's amazing. And you mentioned those production numbers earlier, which I love because they almost remind me of something right out of the Muppet Show. And, you know, the most recent one that I watched last night, you actually did a little tribute to Hamilton. I really enjoyed that.
No, we actually did. It's funny when we talked about, when you talked to me about being here, I thought because I'm not in New York, I don't know a lot about Broadway and what's going on, except that everything's closed right now. So I thought, well, what can I do? And I, frankly, I've not seen Hamilton, but you can see so much about it online. So we kind of did a takeoff on, Weldon did a seance last night. And the person he brought back from the dead was Alexander Hamilton. But the thing about Weldon's production numbers is he plays all the parts. So if it's Hamilton, he plays Hamilton. If it's, I'm doing something else. You know, we did a Tiger King one, which we call the Ogre King. And Weldon played about five different characters, you know, from the Tiger King. So it's a silly way to do parody. And it is rather Muppet-like, I think. I mean, that's my background and what I was mentored in. So it's what I want to do.
And, you know, it's been nice. I know that you're taping it back home in Atlanta, but you've brought a little of that, like, RZA the Rat New York edge to the character. It makes it very relatable for us up north.
Well, I think RZA, of all the characters I've ever done over all the years, RZA was always my favorite. Because he was a character that I did originally, and I did that character for about 40 years. And being, you know, not that I didn't love Kermit, of course, but RZA was my own kind of thing, and I did less of RZA. So he was this snarky kind of character, and I would say Weldon is like a mixture of RZA and Oscar the Grouch times about 10, you know. He can get away with being a little bit more edgy because we're on the internet, although I did make a conscious decision to keep it sort of family-friendly. At the time when I started doing Weldon, I read something on the internet where parents were being sort of you know, snookered into getting their kids to watch stuff that was showing up on children's channels, but then right in the middle of it, it would go very blue. And I thought, well, I could do anything I want to, and you can always get laughs that way. But I thought, you know, let's keep it clean.
Yeah, it's very easy to get cheap laughs by, you know, making a puppet say like a four-letter yeah. word or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, speaking of RZA, one question I get asked a lot, Steve, what's your favorite film about Broadway? And there's been some cool ones over the years, but as they often say, you never forget your first, which for me was The Muppets Take Manhattan, which is kind of like RZA's coming out party, yeah. I think, in a lot of ways. And I can't think of many better films that capture the spirit and the essence of New York City and Broadway better than that one. And, you know, almost 40 years later, when you look back on that production in particular, and filming here in the city, what stands out the most?
Oh, my goodness. Well, honestly, and I can talk about the production, too. In addition to the production, my wife and I were there, and she worked on the film as well, and we both had to find a place to live temporarily over a summer. And it was, I always thought it was hot in the South in the summer. It's the first summer I'd spent the whole summer in New York City. It was dreadful. And, I mean, incredibly hot. We're outside on locations. Everybody's sweating. We discovered two things that summer. One was HBO. It's the first time we'd ever had HBO in an apartment. Second was Haagen-Dazs. So we went. So our normal routine was to go to work every day, go back to our little apartment place we had rented, and go, you know, watch HBO and plow through a pint of ice cream each. So by the end of the shoot, we both put on about 20 pounds, and we were also in the middle of shooting Fraggle Rock during that time. So by the time I got back to Fraggle, I kind of had to like go on this diet to lose about 20 pounds, you know. But it was a great summer, and Frank Oz directed that film. And of course, Jim was alive at that point. And we had just an enormous amount of fun. I have some home movies that I did on Super 8 film of that whole thing that nobody's ever seen. Someday maybe I'll show them somewhere. But just us out on the street being silly and doing our stuff and rolling around on the ground, you know.
And, you know, you and Jim got to do a pretty iconic scene as you were doing RZA and he was doing Kermit at the time at Sardi's, which is one of our favorite places to grab a little bite before a show. Sure if you've been back since, but, you know, Sardi's still keeps that caricature of Kermit from the actual movie up on the wall.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. I haven't been there in a long time. That's great to know. Yeah, yeah. And we really shot in the restaurant that day. I mean, we were like, you know, five of us. You know, the funny thing about the rats, because the rats were quite small little puppets. So you've got these big people trying to get little tiny puppets into this tiny little space, in particular around Kermit for that particular scene. And so all, you know, we've got this big restaurant and then right in this little spot, we've got, you know, seven people all clumped together, you know, under a table. You know, it was great fun though. I loved doing that film a lot.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
You did so much great work in New York City, and I feel like it would probably be impossible to chat with you about, you know, New York in particular, not touch on one of the most famous streets in the city. And I want to touch on something that someone told me that back in the 90s, Sesame Street used to get so excited for you and Frank Oz to come on set, where they would block off like two whole weeks where it would just be the two of you guys on the floor at Kaufman Astoria Studios, and you were doing either Bert and Ernie or Kermit or Grover, and you were like making the crew lose it to the point that they forgot they were on the set of a kid's show. And, you know, when you look back on in your time doing Ernie and an iconic character like that, can you talk a little bit about what that meant to you and maybe some of your highlights from the, I guess, 23 years you were on Sesame Street?
Well, you know, that was around the beginning of the time that I did two of Jim's characters, shortly after his death in 1990 when I was doing Kermit and Ernie. And I had not, you know, well, when I first started working for Jim in 78, Jim had talked about that I might work on Sesame Street. As it turned out, he chose to bring me to London to work on The Muppet Show. And so for the next 12 years, I visited Sesame, but I never worked on the show. So my opportunity to actually work on Sesame Street didn't come about until after Jim's death and then taking on a couple of his characters. And of course, Frank was still doing all of his characters at that point. So we would have these days where we would do a week or two where it was nothing but Ernie and Bert inserts, or as you say, Kermit Grover kind of things. And it was great for me because, you know, it's really interesting. It was very hard for me to take over Jim's characters, as you might imagine, emotionally as well as just trying to do them justice. And working alongside Frank was a big part of being able to make that possible. It was as though the characters that Jim and Frank did together had this odd chemistry that was beyond the two men who did them. It was like, you know, Ernie and Bert had a chemistry. And of course that was Jim and Frank, but it's like those two characters had the chemistry. So when Bert would do what Bert was supposed to do, I sort of instinctively knew what Ernie was supposed to do. That they had a relationship. And it was like there was this sort of vibe in the air that surpassed the two guys, you know?
Oh, that's amazing. I can only imagine, you know, especially considering how closely you worked with Jim. I don't think it would be possible to take those on unless you had worked so closely with him.
Yeah. Well, I think so too. I think so too. It, you know, the Muppets have been consistently done by the same people all those years while Jim was alive. And really, Jim's, a part of Jim's outlook toward the Muppets was quite objective. I think he thought of the Muppets as just being, you know, the puppets were tools that he used to express himself and his puppeteers used to express themselves. And if you were someone who was watching the Muppets, whether it was the Muppet Show or Sesame or anything else, you were sort of seeing right past those puppets. You were seeing the people. And what was going on underneath those puppets really was characteristic of the people. So they really was just like people wearing masks, you know, or playing a part. The Muppets, Frank used to say the Muppets were less puppets and more characters.
Now, let me ask you, so you have an established character like Kermit the Frog or Ernie. They had, you know, been around forever, you know, to the point when once you had taken them on, how do you develop that character and, you know, kind of make it so it's not a stale copy, so to speak?
Yeah, I think that ties into what we were just mentioning, because it'd be very easy to, you know, say, well, I'm going to gather all the material. If I could, you know, now you go watch YouTube and I'm going to look at everything Jim ever did. And I'm going to, you know, really try to get into who that character was. But you really can't do it that way. What clued me in, and I sort of knew this, I don't know, it seemed instinctive, because I knew that Jim was Kermit and Kermit was Jim and Ernie was Jim, you know, I started thinking about the things that Jim did when he was performing those characters. You know, we would make these extreme faces underneath the characters where we're, you know, overacting in our own faces to push this performance out through our hands, you know. And I worked closely enough with Jim that I remember what he looked like when he did Kermit, a face he made or a certain expression. And I also was able to kind of decipher between the things that he did that were kind of just Kermit, and then the things that were Jim that he did that went into Kermit. You know, you'd go to dinner with Jim and he would do things that were very Kermit-like. And I'd say, oh, that's Jim, but he does that as Kermit as well. You know, certain speech patterns and pacing and expressions he would use. And so that all really came in handy. I really don't think I would have been able to do either of those characters without having known Jim.
There was one I wanted to ask you about because it was probably my favorite as a young kid, because I'll never forget like going to Blockbuster and getting the VHS tape for the first time. And I feel like a lot of our folks in the audience would probably appreciate this, because I think you did like a Sesame 30th anniversary special at Radio City Music Hall. And I remember Kermit doing the Sesame Street news flash, like right in front of those brass doors. And I think you got to sing as Kermit and Ernie with Jimmy Buffett and Sean Colvin in that one. I know you're a big music guy too. Do you have any great memories of that? I feel like that's just like the biggest dream come true for a performer.
Well, Jimmy Buffett and his whole band are just the most laid back, decent, nice people you will ever want to meet. I mean, just the nicest guys. And we just sat around and talked about life. I mean, there, you know, in between takes, we did a song called Caribbean Amphibian, I think was the one we did with him. And I mean, he's terrific. He's just an amazing person. And he loved performing with Kermit, as most of our celebrities did. And then the Sean Colvin piece that we did with Ernie, we actually shot in California in the desert. I can't remember all the locations, but I know I distinctly remember being lying down in the back of a car driving through the desert at dusk. I can't remember the piece exactly, but I remember the car in the desert. And it was, it was always fun when we worked with people who loved the Muppets. And I can't think of a single celebrity over the years. There were a lot of them who didn't find some joy in working with these characters, you know?
Yeah, and you got to work with a lot of special ones. I do have to know, though, did Buffett take you out for margaritas after the shoot that day?
Well, no, we didn't quite go that far. I had a work day the next day, so I'm sure he and his guys did that. But
Now, switching gears to Kermit, because I think that's really, such a huge part of your legacy. Obviously, you know, to step into that character, I like you mentioned before, how intimidating it is. Do you have a favorite project or a certain moment where you felt like you arrived and you felt as though you really captured the essence of that character to the point, you know, you went on to do it for 27 years. That can't be easy. Right. So was there a certain moment where you're like, damn, I got this?
A couple of things were nice in that regard. I honestly, throughout all the years, I was constantly always coming up with new things for Kermit to do and new parts of him that were being added. What was important to me, and you used the words lineage earlier, was that Jim had, you know, wanted, indirectly suggested I did this. He was looking for someone to do Kermit in case he got too busy to do Kermit. And though he had never talked to me about it, I guess he had mentioned it to other people. So I felt a great responsibility for this. And I knew that if Kermit simply became just a copy of Jim, he would get very stale very quickly and he would lose his connection to the audience. So I was always trying to add new things and movements he could do and parts of his personality, but keep them based on Jim's original. I remember when we did The Muppet Christmas Carol, which was the first big project we did after Jim's death, where, you know, we had done a couple little things, but all of a sudden I was cast as Kermit. Not only cast as Kermit in a big movie, but also Kermit was playing someone other than himself. So it was like twice removed, you know, very interesting, fun little thing to figure out from an acting point of view. But so when we were doing the promotional work on that film, we would, we'd do all these interviews and we'd have like a day of interviews and everybody would go to Kermit. And I remember Jerry Nelson was doing Robin, Kermit's nephew, next to me. And at the end of the first interview, we worked together during the film, but he turned, because it was all improvised during the interviews, and he turned and said, "You've really got this now." And I thought, an objective opinion from someone who worked with Jim since basically the beginning. And I realized that maybe I was onto it. You know, maybe I had latched into it at a good point. So that was good to hear that, kind of reinforcement from someone who didn't have to say that if they didn't believe it, you know? But I think that film kind of crystallized Kermit, at least to a certain degree, at that point, was really being thrown into a big project and having to sink or swim.
And it's amazing, you know, in those early Kermit years, you guys were doing those great films. And you mentioned Kermit playing a character other than himself. You know, Muppet Treasure Island comes to mind, too. And you got to work with these great, iconic songwriters, because you got to work with Paul Williams on Muppet Christmas Carol, and then Barry Mann and Cynthia Wilde on Muppet Treasure Island. That must have just been, like, incredible. Now, let me ask you, when you're recording, let's say, One More Sleep Till Christmas, which is probably, we got the holidays coming up, no better song for this time of year. And, you know, even you did like Sailing for Adventure and all those great, there was Cabin Fever, all those great songs from Muppet Treasure Island. Were they in the studio with you? And one other thing I'm curious about is, you know, when you're performing Kermit or Ernie or Rizzo, any of these characters in a recording studio, is it tough to channel the, because, you know, you're not just a voiceover artist, you're a puppeteer. Is it tough to channel the characters without the actual puppet in front of you when you're singing songs like that?
Well, you know, it was tough on Christmas Carol, because that was, again, my first project where I'd really done Kermit in a major way. And Paul Williams was there. Paul was there. And we went in to sing. And I remember being very nervous about that the day before and thinking, you know, this is going to be tough, because, you can get away with a certain amount of latitude if you're doing the puppet while you're doing the voice. People are watching the puppet and hearing the voice, and they might forgive you a little for the voice. So suddenly I'm going into the studio, there's no puppet to hide behind, just me in front of a mic and Paul Williams, right, and a bunch of people. So I'm thinking, well, this is going to be intimidating. And it was. And I remember, I did One More Sleep Till Christmas. Paul just, they just rolled the track, and I just sung it as Kermit. And Paul, in my ears, very, I had the headphones on, in my ears very quietly, he said, "Now that's Kermit." And I was relieved. I took a deep breath. I was fine. And we picked it. Basically, he took the first take. And then he picked up bits and pieces. I had rehearsed it. But there's only so much rehearsal you can do. You have to just shut your eyes and sing the thing. Especially a song as pure as that. You know, it's either going to be Kermit or it's not going to be Kermit. You know.
That's so true. Do you have a favorite Muppet project that you got to work on, Steve?
I think my favorite show that I ever worked on was probably Fraggle Rock. I know that's a different set of characters, you know, other than the standard Muppet Show Muppets. But Fraggle was an interesting project. You know, Jim set that project up and then was only there a little bit of the time. We shot in Toronto. We had an incredible group of people, an amazing crew. We really talk about becoming a family with that group of people on that show as much as anything I've ever worked on. Everyone was involved and everyone was putting in suggestions. And, you know, anybody's suggestions were listened to. You know, it was very collaborative. And I don't mean just the creative people. I mean, like the grips, you know, if they'd say, we don't think that's in character. And we'd pay attention to that, you know. That was also at the point in my sort of development as a puppeteer with Jim's company. I was about 5 years in. And Jim used to say, I remember him saying in the very beginning, it usually took people about 5 years to get accustomed to the way he liked to do things. And he was right. And at my fifth year there, just about, is when Wimbley Fraggle came along and Sprocket. And it was, you know, I was, you know, as light as Wimbley was, it was really me sinking my teeth into a character. Although Wimbley was largely just me at that age. His indecisiveness and the silliness of the character was... You know, his hummingbird metabolism was a lot of who I was when I was about 23.
It's so funny you say that, the indecisiveness, because I didn't watch Fraggle Rock that much growing up, but the scene that I love and always stand out to me is, I think it was you and Jim together doing Wembley and convincing John, and the whole point of the number was that, like, Wembley couldn't make a decision, and convincing John is going to tell it, sell it, spell it, just for you. And that was like the whole point of the scene. At the end, like, Wembley gets all tough and macho. I'll never forget that.
It was great. And it was very special to all of us when Jim would come through town, you know, and he'd direct an episode, or he had a couple of characters. He did Convincing John was one. He did one called Cantus, who was kind of this roaming minstrel who came through, and he was very kind of, you know, almost double talk, but kind of this very spiritual character who would say prophetic things, you know, and play music. And anyway, so Jim, it was really Jim coming through town, you know, as these characters. So just great fun all the way around, everything about that show.
That was such a special one. And, you know, you shine in so many different ways during your time with the Muppets. I particularly loved those live appearances, whether it would be, you know, if you were on Kimmel or Fallon, or even during the Macy's Parade, I remember you would do some stuff with Kermit and Ernie, even alongside our friend of the show, Al Roker. When you get to improv like that, how much fun is that for a performer?
Well, I think it's probably the most fun thing that I ever did. I mean, in terms of anticipating doing something, that's what I always was the most thrilled about going to do. We go to a film and you do your lines and you know, I mean, the secret of working in a film like that, and I suppose this is true with any actor, is to improvise what's written, essentially. You know, you have to make it your own words, but it's not quite the same. And I always found that all the characters grew during our PR times, because suddenly they're on their own and they're being challenged with questions and situations. And that's when I would discover new things about the character oftentimes, Kermit in particular. Because, you know, once I was doing Kermit, I was doing a lot of Kermit. I was very busy as Kermit. And even during downtimes when people weren't really necessarily seeing the Muppets doing things, I was still out there doing appearances all over the place. And Al Roker, you mentioned Al. I just love Al Roker. And, you know, we don't see each other much these days, but we did many things together over the years, including the parades. And he's just one of those people that, you know, you go back to the Today Show and he's always there and he gives you a hug. And then I drop down on the floor and we do what we do, you know. But my favorite thing is always the improvisation, which is why I kind of enjoy going back to this cave-in thing, because most of that is improvised. So it's something I always love doing.
Were there any personalities in the media or folks from the entertainment industry that you think worked particularly well with the Muppets, or even folks who kind of struggled to channel, you know, what it would take to put on a good show with these characters, you know, that you're performing on your hands right next to them?
Well, you know, we worked with so many different celebrities during the Muppet Show. I mean, it was a different celebrity every week. I did the second half of those 5 years, but total it was 120 or more people. And so once in a while, you'd have somebody come in who was kind of like less comfortable looking in the eyes of the puppet, you know, than they were. They kind of look past the puppet down to you, you know, you're down here. And I don't think it ever showed particularly, but there was a certain comfort level. Some people could just immediately drop into working with the puppets. I mean, we did a lot of work with John Denver, which I loved. He was a terrific person, and we really got to know him. You know, once in a while, you'd have celebrities come in that you'd work with for the two or three days on the Muppet Show, and then they were wonderful, but you probably didn't ever see them again or, you know them again. But we had people like John Denver, you know, the Star Wars guys. We kind of got to know Anthony Daniels and Peter Mayhew and Mark Hamill. We kept up with them for a while. One of my favorite guys to work with was always Tom Bergeron. I love Tom. I mean, we still keep in touch all the time. We did a lot of Dancing with the Stars and other things together, Hollywood Squares. Henry Winkler's a great friend. I mean, there's a few people who really click with the characters. Just treat them like real people is really the secret.
Yeah, it comes off on screen. It's funny, you mentioned, I've seen a lot of the John Denver stuff that you guys did both on The Muppet Show, and you did that holiday special, I remember back.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was late 70s or early 80s. And the other guy I always thought was good was Jeffrey Tambor. That was really, I thought he was good too.
Jeffrey's great. He's another person who just clicked with the puppets so well, with different puppet characters. He was very comfortable with them. Particularly, actually, I have to say, with Bill Beretta's characters, Jeffrey and Bill really click together well. Their style of humor plays off of each other quite well. It's a more of a dry sense of humor. And Jeffrey is so good at that.
Now, you mentioned Bill Beretta, one of my favorites. Do you still keep in touch with a lot of the Muppet guys?
A little bit. You know, they're doing their thing and I'm doing mine. And I tend to be so busy with what I'm doing that we have kind of gone our separate ways to a large degree. But they're all out there doing their stuff. And Bill, probably as much as anybody. But, you know, Bill and I loved working with Bill so much, especially with Pepe and Rizzo, Pepe the Prawn. And those two little guys were, you know, there's so much more I would love to have done with those two, because they were great fun together. These two little spunky guys who were just, you know, both kind of stupid, but they were, you know, falling off of each other, you know, talking and, you know.
Now, this one might be a little bit of a tricky subject. I just want to preface to my audience that I do like the Walt Disney Company. I'm a lifelong fan. Disneyland, one of my true happy places. I'm a Disney Plus subscriber. I've even talked about that recently. Yep. But when Disney first bought the Muppets in 2004, there was a lot of dysfunction when it came to picking the right people to run the Muppet Studio, as far as trying to integrate the characters under a very new structure for you guys. And I know Frank Oz has spoken out about how they don't trust the performers. You had some very fair grievances over the years. How soon into the relationship did you realize that there were going to be some problems?
Well, it was when I look, you know, hindsight's 20/20. The fellow who was the original executive who came along, who was going to oversee the Muppets at the very top. We were shooting this film called Muppets Wizard of Oz, which probably not one of our most shining moments, but it was, anyway, we shot the thing. And it was kind of the first thing that was during that crossover time in 2004. And very enthusiastic young fellow, and he came in and he was shook your hand, and we're going to have such great fun together. Within the first paragraph of the sentences he was saying, he said, and we're going to get a dozen people to do each of the core characters so we can have them all over the world at the same time. And I think all of us who were kind of those main performers, our faces probably, I can't imagine what our faces, it must have just dropped. It's exactly the wrong thing to do with the Muppets, because they are so individual. And you know, it's kind of exactly the wrong thing to do. So that initiative went forward for a while. We politely fought against it and prevailed once there was a new set of executives coming in, not because they wouldn't have done it, but because they realized they really didn't need to do it. So why have a problem over it? You know, right. There wasn't enough work. Why do you need 12 people? There wasn't enough work for 12 Kermits, you know? And it would have just sucked all the life right out of the characters. They would have become this sort of amalgamated, this stack of traits, you know, and all these people would have been boiled down to a set of traits, and they would have just become stale, you know, no connection with the audience. So that didn't happen, thank goodness. Maybe it won't ever happen. So I knew pretty early on we had a little issue there.
Now, this is just from my research, and this does seem to be accurate. I find it interesting that the folks that were involved in that last ABC series are no longer with the Disney company. I just thought that was pretty interesting. And they were the ones that made the pretty unpopular decision a couple of years ago to recast Kermit and whatnot. So I was just like, I don't know it seems like there was a whole like mirage of, you know, folks that they brought in to try to make it work. And you guys did there were some great projects that I particularly loved. I did like the 2011 Muppet film, but I know, you know, Frank has spoken out about it in different ways, but you know, there was some good stuff there, but I do find that interesting that these folks that made such a big decision aren't even with the Muppets anymore.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I often, you know, I mean, in my dreams, I keep thinking, God, maybe I should just go back and talk to the new people there and say, maybe, you know, I'm probably not who I was portrayed to be. So I'll let you make that judgment for yourself, but maybe we could try this again. After all, I was there for nearly 40 years. Maybe, you know, I could take a 4-year break and come back. It was just an odd thing, you know. I felt like there was never any problem that we couldn't work out. And one of the things that bothered me the most is I think an awful lot of people felt that the reason I was asked to leave, well, I wasn't asked to leave, okay, but anyway, the reason I was recast was because I was gouging for a lot of money. And that was not the case. I was making the same money when I left that I was 14 years before when I came in. I never raised my fees. It didn't make sense. You know, when you're doing as many as 6 or 7 projects a week, you don't go back and renegotiate each one of those. They need to know what they're going to pay you. Otherwise, you can't be nimble enough to get the work done. You know, so it was always a flat fee, and that's the way it worked. But I think the real issue in the end, and I think I can say this, it's not a big, I've said it before, it was very important to me that every project we did, those of us who were overseeing it, you know, and those executives as well, needed to look at that project through the eyes of the characters, not just through the corporate eyes and not even through our own eyes, but what does this project look like from the point of view of the characters? And if it doesn't suit that character or the group dynamic of all the characters, doesn't mean it has to go away. It means we need to rethink it. You know, let's really decide whether this suits the Muppets. And part of what I felt was important for the characters to be handled in the way that Jim did this was for the performers to be treated well. Now, what I mean by that is that we all get our health insurance and our pensions because we're part of SAG-AFTRA. And so I never wanted to do anything that should be under the unions without it being under the unions. And I was occasionally asked to let that go. And if there was no clear classification, I would do it. You know, I'd say, okay, well, you know, but they don't have an opinion. If they had an opinion, I would say, look, you guys, you need to bring this up to your producers. You're supposed to do this. You're hiring us. So that was really the ultimate issue in the end, situations over the union issues. And, you know, should I have stood up for it? Well, yeah, I guess I should have. Nobody was yelling and screaming at each other. I was just saying, you need to do this right. You need to treat your puppeteers like Jim treated his puppeteers. You need to respect them and treat them well. I wasn't the only person speaking up for that, but I was the only person willing to really put anything on the line for it. And look where it got me.
On the Break of Bad podcast, talking about what can make the Muppets again. Listen, Steve, it's no secret that the new version of Kermit the Frog has missed the mark for a lot of people, myself included. Do you think that, you know, I'm not sure if you know who the new executives are, but would they be open to bringing in someone like you or a Frank Oz, you know, to help right the ship?
I don't know. I don't know them. I haven't met them. The new folks who've come in. I understand. I mean, you know, I keep up with a couple of people, and they've all said that the person who's directly in charge is just terrific to work with and talk to, and really wants to learn, and doesn't pretend to know everything about the Muppets, and would really like to learn. The thing that's slightly concerning for me is that there's barely anybody left. Dave is still there, Dave Goals, but there's nobody there left who really worked with Jim. Now, it makes me sound old. I don't want to sound like I'm stuck and it's got to be a certain set of ways, but I think it needs to be built on a foundation. I think for things to evolve and be progressive, they need to rest on the foundation from where they started and then grow from that. But that foundation, that core is important. And I think a lot of that is lost. We did the ABC series a few years ago, and it got, most people didn't like it. There are things about it I liked, things about it I wasn't crazy about. The tone of the show was a little too slow for me. I think the puppetry, the actual like physical stuff we did with the characters was in some cases kind of mind-blowing. It was really good. I was very proud of our puppet work. And even, you know, just the acting to try to make the characters so subtle, but I just think we went a little too far with that. You know, I don't think it was quite right. But again, that's tone, you know, and tone comes from where the Muppets were, you know, and how they started and what Jim felt they were and what we all felt they were back in, you know, back in the 80s. And they don't have to be stuck there, but it'd be nice if they were still built upon that. And I'm afraid we've lost that. No one has any direct reference to the originators of the characters anymore. And they wouldn't have it if I was there either, really, except that I have that. And what I had hoped to be able to do was to bring that in. And I still believe that it could be integrated back into a big company like Disney. I don't think it has to be, well, there's the corporate side and the creative side and all that stuff with the Muppets. It doesn't matter. We just need to make money. That doesn't matter. In order for them to be financially successful, they need to be creatively successful. And that starts with them being based on who they are.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you always channeled those characters in such a great way, you know, sometimes in spite of the writing. I mean, I think that what you were able to accomplish was just incredible. And, you know, you've accomplished pretty much everything there is in the puppetry world. Is there like one master fantasy project that's kind of swirling in your mind right now that you'd like to bring to life?
Well, there's two. One of them I won't talk about because it's something I might try to do one day. It has nothing to do with the Muppets. It's a big, ambitious thing that I would like to try to do on my own with 100 other people. But it's something I'd like to head up and do. It wouldn't translate into anything the Muppets would do. There is also a project that I was due to pitch within the Muppets. Had I been there for another month, it would have happened because I'd been invited to pitch this. There were a lot of things I was told that I was invited to do that didn't quite happen in the end. But that's another story. but I was going to pitch this thing. I was co-writing it with one of the Muppet writers. And actually, they were writing and I was just making suggestions. I was almost more producing it. I believe this, I know this, I don't want this to sound arrogant, but I truly believe it would be the definitive project that would have turned the Muppets around. It was a multi-part series, probably at the time I called it a Netflix-like series. Limited kind of thing, probably six episodes sort of thing, that I really believe would have reintroduced the Muppets to the new generation of viewers in a way that it would have made them the Muppets, their Muppets, but still left them based on who they are. It was an origin story. It was nothing like the Muppet movie, but it could have mirrored that kind of a feeling. The Muppets retelling people who they are at this point. And then as a springboard, it would have moved on from there. And unfortunately, at this moment, I bet that project never gets made. Because my name's on it for one thing. And, but you know, if I ever was back there, that's the first thing I would ask them to look at. Cause I really think it would turn everything around.
Yeah. And listen, I'm being blunt here, but they need that right now. They need someone to turn it around. And, you know, for a lot of the reasons that you just said, it's not happening at the moment, but, you know, On a brighter side, we do a little segment on the show, Steve, called Fastball Derby. And you are a master storyteller. It's a chance for you to, you know, let the fans know a little bit more about you and some of your fond memories. And, you know, just to use the baseball terminology, I want you to think of this as like the bottom of the ninth inning. There's two outs. The game's on the line. You know, you've hit a bunch of home runs in this game or this episode so far. This is your chance, your chance to bring home the winning run. So I'll ask you some questions and you just tell me what comes to mind.
Okay. All right. I will try.
Favorite New York City meal.
So, I'm sorry. Say again.
Favorite New York City meal.
Meal. Oh my God. See, look what you've done to me. All right. I know my favorite New York City meal, and the restaurant has gone out of my head. Doggone it.
What's the food genre, Stevie? I could probably help you with
Indian,
that.
Indian. It's gone. Indian food. It's gone. Shoot. It's some little place. I haven't eaten there in 6 years, so the place has gone out of my head. It's over on Broadway. Oh, my God. Okay. Well, what came to mind was Indian.
Okay.
Now, I've taken 20 minutes to answer your quick question. Every type of what we used to call ethnic food in New York, like Indian, Thai, it's all outstanding. Chinese, you know.
Yeah, then you got the best of the best there. How about this one? We've got Thanksgiving right around the corner. Best your favorite story about performing in the Macy's Parade?
Oh, I was afloat, like just barely off the ground in what amounted to a coffin, lying in this thing. Kermit was singing a Christmas song, sitting on top of a log. And in order for me to be flat on the deck, I had to lie, you know, imagine lying flat on your back with your arms straight out in front of you, so it's sticking straight up, for about 4 hours. Which means just forget it if you need to go to the bathroom. There's no chance of that. But the best part was I was the only person in the parade that the parade allowed to have a live microphone. It's throughout the parade. It's not allowed. And I was able to, and I had a monitor so I could see with little cameras all over the float. I could pinpoint people and Kermit could talk to them. And the response from the crowd was just emotionally overwhelming because they knew it was not just some guy doing a puppet. It was actually Kermit. It was an amazing New York moment.
Love that. Now, you did some promotional work, by the way, at Yankee Stadium, and I think Kermit was sitting in one of the seats. Was it kind of like the same setup where you're kind of like buried under the seats there, just really uncomfortable?
Yeah, I did something at some point with Mayor Bloomberg where we were sitting next to he was there with Kermit, and I'm down on the ground for hours. The thing I remember the most about it, and I don't think it was on purpose, but he's sitting to my left and I'm reaching across with Kermit, so they look like they're sitting in a couple of seats right at home plate as well as I remember. And he was eating peanuts and he kept throwing the shells down on me. I'm down there and they're falling all over my face. You know, I'm peanut shells everywhere while I'm trying to talk as Kermit.
Oh my goodness. Usually you just have
the hazards of working under show business, you know.
Yeah, usually it's just the drunk fans in the upper deck that are like peanut shells and beer, you know, down on people. But yeah, good to know that the mayor of New York City, that's what he liked to do.
Yeah.
I'm cracking up. I'm glad I brought that one up.
Oh yeah, that really happened.
Now, this is actually a question from my little cousin Sal, who wants to know, which was the most fun Muppet movie you got to make?
Well, you know, I'm going to have to give you two answers. But my favorite probably was, because I had so little actual responsibility, and it was the very original The Muppet Movie with Rainbow Connection and all of that original stuff. It was my first film, but it was also The Muppets' first feature film. And I was 19 years old. I had just gotten married, went off to California, my wife and I, to work on a movie at 19 years old. And it was just an amazing thing to happen. So much fun. I got to do so much work and I was just filling in. I did a lot of filling in for other puppeteers doing their characters. Like I did a lot of Fozzie when Frank was doing Piggy and stuff like that, you know. And the other, I would have to say that Muppet Christmas Carol is a favorite. Again, because it was the first film we did after Jim passed away. And I know in my own mind, it gave me a sense that we were actually going to be able to make a go of this without him. You know, as hard as it was a very emotional film for us. But it sort of said, you know what, we might get away with this.
How about this one? This is a two-parter. All-time favorite performance as Ernie and all-time favorite performance as Kermit.
One of my favorite things I ever did with Ernie was a guest spot on the Today Show with Katie Couric. It was Ernie and Bert. And it was right after Eric Jacobson had begun to do Bert. Frank was not available, and Eric was now doing Bert. So Eric was less comfortable doing a live spot, rightly so, because he wasn't that accustomed to being Bert yet. I was fine with Ernie at that point. I've been doing it for a while. And so it's funny because, I mean, this is Eric likes to prepare, and he's much less prepared about that now. He can do more improvisation, but he came in with a massive number of scripted things. And I remember thinking, this first time we'd done this type of thing together, you know, you're not going to be able to use any of that, because by the time, first of all, you have to hope she asks you that question that you've got an answer written to. And second of all, by the time you find it on your paper, it's too late. You needed to answer already in a live situation. So Katie Couric would ask a question. And Ernie's take on this, by the way, was they were in the studio, but Ernie, being from Sesame Street, he didn't know what a studio was. So Ernie kept saying, you know, gee, Katie, you have a great apartment here. You know, he thought it was her place. So that was our conceit. And she would ask a question, and Bert, I would give Eric a little pause, like as long as you could give somebody to answer while he's looking for his answer. And then I would jump in really quick. And so Bert didn't do much talking because it was just hard. It's so hard when you first start out, you know. But that one stood out, and it was fun. And the conceit of Ernie thinking it was her apartment was fun. She was always fun to work with. Probably my favorite little thing I ever did with Kermit was Queen Elizabeth's Jubilee. It was her... Oh, see, now I'm going to screw it up. Was it her 75th birthday or 75th year as queen? It's one of those. I think it was the year as queen. It was this called A Party at the Palace. And it was this massive concert out on the lawn of Buckingham Palace. And I had this tiny little thing I had to do. All Kermit was doing the whole evening was sitting on the edge of the stage. They cut to him for 30 seconds and he introduced somebody. So again, no real responsibility. Kermit just had to say, ladies and gentlemen, you know, here is so-and-so. It was just a little moment. But what I got to do was be at Buckingham Palace all day long and sit in the front row while people like Paul McCartney did their sound check. And Queen and, you know, so, and, you know, I'm the only, like me and two other people who were with me were sitting in the front row while Paul McCartney's there. And he'd say, how do I sound? Do I sound okay? Not, you know, you mean, and then they'd adjust and he'd say, what about now? So it was that kind of thing. And then backstage, Paul McCartney comes over to me, says, okay, so, and he didn't look at me. He just puts his head down and puts his ear to me. And he says, so let me hear it. And I didn't know what he was talking about. It didn't click. And he said, I want to hear it. And I'm standing there like an idiot. I'm a little bit starstruck, of course. And he said, the voice, I want to hear the voice. He wanted to hear Kermit's voice. So that's what he wanted. So he closed his eyes. I did Kermit's voice and he just started laughing. He loved it. So things like that. Ozzy Osbourne standing next to me in a urinal at Buckingham Palace. That was a trip. It was kind of creepy too, frankly. He kind of comes, you know, you're standing there at the urinal. Yeah, you're at a urinal. Women don't have to deal with this. And there are no, you know, it's not no dividers. It's like a portable thing. And somebody comes in and they're going, if it had been anywhere but the palace, you would have run out of the men's room. And this guy kind of sidles up next to you, you know, he goes, hello. And it's Ozzy Osbourne. Pretty weird. Pretty weird.
But what a day.
How often would that happen, right?
The Queen, McCartney, and Ozzy all at one party.
Yeah. And of course, you get to meet the Queen, which is cool, too. I mean, you know, how often do you get to meet Queen Elizabeth, you know? And you have to say all the right things. When you meet the Queen, you're supposed to, there's protocol, and you're meant to follow it. And you first have to refer to her as Your Majesty. That's part of it. You have to say that. Very nice to meet you, Your Majesty, or something like that. Then you can call her ma'am. But those two things. And I had met her once before, and I was so nervous that when she came down the line, she offered her hand. You don't touch her unless she offers her hand. She offered her hand. I took her hand, her little gloved hand, and I said, and I'm very nervous. I said, "It's very nice to meet you. You're ma'am." I couldn't get ma'am and majesty to like click in my brain. And she looked at me. She was so sweet, and she just sort of did this face like, "It's okay. It's really okay." You know, she let me off the hook. You know, she didn't have me thrown in the tower or anything. You know,
I love that one. That's so great. How about this one? Fact about Steve Whitmire that would surprise people the most.
Oh, you know, if you saw me in a lot of my daily life, you'd see me with a chainsaw taking down tree limbs. You'd see me riding around on a farm tractor, you know, bush hogging paths in the woods. I have a little bit of property here, and I really spend a great deal of time doing property management. And it's a great chance to get outdoors, and it's something I can do even when there's a pandemic, you know, because I'm out there breathing the real air, you know. So, yeah, I think people probably wouldn't expect that. I look like a different person.
How about this one? Place that you were recognized or instance where you were recognized without a puppet on your hand that surprised you the most?
Can I tell you one that made no sense?
Absolutely. There's no rules in fastball derby, Steve. You tell us whatever you want.
Somebody thought they recognized me, and they had no idea who I was. I got out of a cab in New York City with my wife one time, and she handed me the cab receipt to write down, because we were keeping receipts for like tax purposes, right? So I'm signing this thing, and I hand it to her. She turns to walk away, and three teenagers come running over and say, "Can we have your autograph?" And I said, "Oh, but you don't even know who I am." And they said, "No, but you just signed an autograph for her." And I said, "No, that was my cab receipt." They didn't know who I was. They just thought I was some guy with long hair who was signing autographs for this other woman. So that was a strange one. And it was a little scary. You know, I thought, wow, this is what people deal with.
Only in New York.
Yeah. Yeah. I had the entire audience from a live show. Tony Danza used to have a talk show. We did the show. We went out to lunch afterwards with a reporter who was working for TV Guide who wanted to do an interview, sitting in this little deli, and all these people kept coming up asking for my autograph. And this guy was like, "And I, what the hell is this?" And the reporter was saying, "Geez, does this happen all the time?" I said, "It never, ever happens." Turns out it was a school group who was in the Tony Danza audience and had seen me at the show. So they didn't know who I was either. They just saw me do Kermit on the show, you know?
Oh, that's amazing. Well, hey, listen, as I mentioned in the intro, I was one of the first people to ask for a Steve Whitmire autograph when I had the chance to meet you.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you. That's nice.
Now, how about this one? You literally toured the world with Jason Segel to promote the 2011 Muppet movie. What's your craziest story from the road with Segel?
Oh, my God. It must have been Mexico City. That was weird. We were... I mean, Jason was crazy and wonderful, and I didn't get to work with him very much during the film. Most of our scenes weren't together. He was shooting with, you know, Peter Lentz and Walter, and I was doing Kermit. They weren't together all that much. And I got to know him far more when we were doing, this is bizarre. I don't think I've told this story. I'm trying to think of a clean way to tell it. So we're doing a day of those interviews, like day two, where we've got, you know, press coming in. Kermit is next to Jason. They've got the camera set up, and a press person sits across from us, and we're doing these one-on-one interviews. And so we're really tired by then. I mean, we're in a different time zone. We were out late the night before having dinner. You know, we're just exhausted. And we're just slugging Red Bull down, you know. And this woman who actually spoke very good English was trying to speak English to us. Because I didn't speak Spanish well at all. And Jason actually learned Spanish over lunch, oddly. It was very strange. He came back from lunch and knew Spanish. I don't get it. But anyhow, she looks at us and she says, her last question, and we were primed to lose it because we were so tired. She looks at us and she says, "So I'm not going to try to do the accent." She said, "So now that you have done the movie, what will... focus in the future?" And we lost it because it didn't sound like folk use. It sounded like what you think I'm saying. He looked at me, I looked at him, and I had to stop. I had to bring the puppet down. I was laughing so hard that I couldn't keep going with Kermit because we thought she said the F word. F use in the future. What she was trying to say was focus. But what she said was F use in the future. And we lost it. We couldn't keep going. We had to stop. Yeah, you kind of had to be there, but it's one of those moments when the giggles were going to happen, and when they did, we had to stop for 15 minutes. And then she was apologizing. I'm so sorry, my English. And we're saying, no, it's not you. You're English. We're so tired. The English is fine. You know.
Oh, I love that. That is so anyway, good.
So bizarre.
How about this? How about this one? You're a big music guy. What's your Desert Island album?
Oh God, there's so many things. I'd have to put it together myself. I love so much different music. What am I listening to? I've kind of gone backward a little bit. I like pulled out the Grand Funk Railroad and the Uriah Heep not so long ago again from my teenage years. A lot of instrumental stuff. Like I used to play keyboards in these high school rock bands. So Rick Wakeman and Keith Emerson and a guy named Patrick Moraz, who's with the Moody Blues. I love their work. If you know who they are, they were with Yes and all those bands. I don't know, about 10 years ago, I got in. Do you know who the Executioners are?
I actually don't. And I love old school classic rock and whatnot, but I don't.
Well, they are like these DJ guys who do scratching stuff with all these rap stars and hip hop guys. And I mean, it's just amazing. It's all rhythmic, amazing stuff. You know, I so much music. So much useless music in my head that I should, if I could clear that out, I'd have so much more space for new things, you know?
Oh, we have two more good ones here. This okay. Next one is, what is your favorite quote, or what is your favorite Rizzo the Rat quote? That's from our listener, Fast Food Nick.
Wow, that's such a great question. Favorite Rizzo, I wish one would pop right into mind. What popped into mind is not necessarily my favorite. The one that gets the most quoted to me is, light the lamp, not the rat, because that just became, when his tail was set on fire. But I can't think of another quote that's very well known. So I guess I have to go with that one just because it gets quoted to me all the time. People love that quote.
That's a great one. I also loved Treasure Island. It's like he died and this is supposed to be a kid's movie.
Yeah. Good lines in that. That was Jerry Jewell and Kirk Thatcher wrote that stuff. And it was an amazing script.
Love that. And this is the last one that we always use to wrap every show, Steve. What's the best piece of advice anyone ever gave you?
Oh, you know, I know that I have a very definitive answer on that. It's never believe your own PR. it comes in handy all the time. I don't mean if your personal PR or like with the Muppets, you know, the greatest thing the Muppets have ever done. Well, you know what? It wasn't really, you know, never believe it. You know, it might be wonderful, but don't believe your own PR. You're better off if you stay more objective about that stuff.
Oh, Steve, this was amazing. And, I'm so grateful that I had the chance to talk to you. For the folks at home who may want to connect with you on social media and with Cave-In or your website, why don't you tell everyone where they could find you online?
Sure. Well, I do a lot of Instagram. It's Steve_Whitmire. So that one's easy. I just actually got a new website up and running in about 2 months ago. That's stevewhitmire.website, not .com, but .website. So it's easy. Steve Whitmire website. Cave-In, the best way to find Cave-In is to go to YouTube and you can search, the name of the channel is Cave-In, you know, with a hyphen in the middle, but there's something else called Cave-In. So why don't you search the character's name, search Weldon, the IT guy, and it'll pop up and all of our shows are there, all the production numbers. If you don't want to sit through these long hour long shows, you can just watch the playlist of production numbers, which are kind of fun.
Well, that's awesome, Steve. And I'm certainly a monthly viewer of Cave-In. You've done such great work with it. And listen, it's such an honor to sit down with you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I thank you for making it so easy. I was so concerned because I thought if he asked me lots of sports questions, I'm in trouble. My one sport thing is that when I was in school, I was throwing a softball around with a bunch of friends one day, throwing it as high in the air as possible and then running under it to catch it. And I looked up at the softball and it was eclipsing like the sun, like the moon would do. So you've got dark ball, bright circle. Just as it got about 10 feet from me to catch, I'm saying, I got it. The eclipse cleared. I got the sun in my eyes. I got hit in the forehead. And I woke up on the ground with three people saying, are you okay?
It's like those scenes like, like Miss Piggy in Great Muppet Camp for all like the birds like kind of flying around your head.
Exactly. That's the extent of my sports experience. My sport career was ended by an injury.
And then you put the glove away for a puppet and it worked out really well.
That's right. It's a different glove. Yeah.
Well, Steve, thank you so much again. This was awesome. For folks at home, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. This is Al Malafronte signing off for Break a Bat and the Broadway Podcast Network. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Break a Bat. This is produced by the fine folks at the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit and subscribe at bpn.fm/breakabat. You can find me online at break_a_bat_podcast. And you can also find the Broadway Podcast Network on Instagram at Broadway Podcast Network. It's been so great having you here with us today, and we'll see you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.